Lowe's knows how to set off your July 4th with savings. Right now, buy one, get one free on select one-coat coverage interior paint via Visa gift card rebate. Plus, get two select 2 or 2.5-quart red, white, and blue annuals for just $10. Hurry, these July 4th deals won't last long. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, excludes Alaska and Hawaii. More terms and restrictions apply. See Lowe's.com/rebates for more details.
So far on this second season of Solving JFK, we've covered the life of Lee Harvey Oswald as a kid growing up, when he was in the Marines, when he defected to Russia, and when he returned to Dallas in 1962. Most recently, we did a deep dive on the backyard photos and the General Walker shooting. One of the backyard photos was put on the cover of Life magazine in February of 1964, when the American public was waiting on the Warren Commission to issue its report. The General Walker shooting and the backyard photos made Oswald look like a communist-sympathizing Russian defector who had guns and, based on the Walker shooting allegation, wasn't afraid to use them. In late April of 1963, Oswald moved from Dallas to New Orleans. Over the next several weeks, we'll examine the evidence to try to find out what Oswald was up to in the Big Easy. In this episode, we look at Oswald's arrival in New Orleans, his employment at Riley Coffee Company, and the claims made by Judith Vary Baker about her relationship with Lee Harvey Oswald.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas. The first reports say that President Kennedy has been seriously wounded by this shooting.
The flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
This is Solving JFK. I'm your host, Matt Crumpton. On April 25th, 1963, Lee Harvey Oswald arrived in New Orleans by bus. He stayed with his Aunt Lillian and Uncle Dutz Moret at 757 French Street for a week or two. Lillian Moret's Warren Commission timeline on when exactly Oswald arrived isn't very clear, so he may have stayed somewhere else for a few days before he ended up staying at the Moret's. On April 26th, the day after he arrived in New Orleans, Oswald visited the New Orleans Unemployment Claims Office so that he could receive his unemployment benefits. On May 9th, Oswald secured a job at William B. Riley Coffee Company. Around the same time that he started working at Riley Coffee, Oswald signed a lease for an apartment at 4905 Magazine Street. The next day, Ruth Payne, joined by her two small children, drove Marina and June from Irving, Texas to New Orleans. Ruth and her kids stayed with the Oswalds at their tiny apartment on Magazine Street until she returned to Dallas on Tuesday, May 14th. It's important to remember that in the summer of 1963, Cuba was a volatile political issue. We're not going to go too in-depth on Cuba right now. It deserves its own deep dive, which I plan to get to next season. But you'll need a basic understanding of the relationship between the United States and Cuba in 1963 to be able to put all of the New Orleans characters whom we'll soon be discussing in the proper context. In early 1959, Fidel Castro led a coup that ousted former pro-American Cuban dictator Fulgencio Batista. When Castro took over, he began to redistribute land and say things that made it sound like he had communist sympathies. These actions put the world on alert that Cuba would likely side with the Soviet Union. This was concerning to Americans because, as we all know, Cuba is only about 100 miles away from Florida. In 1961, just a few months after being inaugurated, President Kennedy approved what would become a major foreign policy blunder, the Bay of Pigs invasion. The invasion was planned and financed by the Central Intelligence Agency and carried out largely by Cuban exiles. The result was about 500 men being killed or wounded and over 1,200 being taken prisoner. The next year, in 1962, in response to the United States putting nuclear missiles in Italy and Turkey, the Soviets placed nuclear missiles in Cuba. When President Kennedy found out about these missiles, he ordered a blockade of the island, which he called a quarantine to make it sound less aggressive. This quarantine led to the Cuban Missile Crisis, a 13-day period from October 16th to October 28th of 1962, when the likelihood of nuclear war seemed to be at an all-time high. So, after the Bay of Pigs and the Cuban Missile Crisis, if you're a mainstream American in the summer of 1963, you're no fan of the Cubans because they're allies of America's enemy, the Soviet Union. But there were some groups who had more intense disdain for Castro. In particular, anti-communists, certain representatives of the American government, and Cuban exiles, many of whom lost loved ones or property in Cuba because of the Castro regime. And in the summer of 1963, a lot of these people and groups who hated Fidel Castro found themselves in New Orleans. One New Orleans business leader who had very strong anti-Castro views happened to be the owner of the coffee company that employed Oswald, William B. Riley. Riley was a right-winger who showed his desire to oust Castro by providing financial support to Cuban exile groups, including Crusade to Free Cuba Committee, which was led by Sergio Arcacha Smith, and served as a vehicle to raise money for the CIA-backed Cuban Revolutionary Council. Riley also donated to the Information Council of the Americas, known as INCA, which was led by Ed Butler. INCA was a pro-American, anti-communist propaganda organization. Now, there are a lot of new names that we'll be throwing around here, but you'll want to make sure you remember Sergio Arcacha Smith and Ed Butler. We'll be coming back to both of them again later. In addition to William Riley's financial support of anti-Castro groups, there are potentially intelligence ties to the Riley Coffee Company. The company's vice president, William Monahan, was a former FBI agent, in addition to being a charter member of Ed Butler's INCA organization. CIA contract employee Jerry Patrick Hemming told New Orleans District Attorney Jim Garrison's office that William Riley worked for the CIA. And that idea is supported by a January 31st, 1964 CIA memo that says, quote, Riley Coffee was of interest as of April 1949 and was assigned agency number EE-334. On May 13th, Oswald started his job as an equipment maintenance man at Riley Coffee. The company grinded, bagged, and sold coffee, and Oswald's specific job was to keep the machines well-oiled. But Oswald wasn't there very long. He would only work at Riley Coffee for about 2 months, with his last day being July 22nd. According to the Warren Report, Oswald was fired from the coffee company for inefficiency and inattention to his work, basically for being a bad worker. Given the amount of time that Oswald spent reading magazines at the next door garage, it's not surprising that he would have been let go. The Crescent City Garage, next door to Riley Coffee, had a waiting room with a Coca-Cola vending machine. Riley Coffee employees would often sit in the waiting room on their breaks, read magazines, and drink Coca-Colas. Adrian Alba was the owner of the garage. He told the Warren Commission that Oswald would come into the garage, buy a Coke, and lose track of time reading the 80 to 120 magazines that were in the garage's waiting room. Oswald would also often discuss guns with Alba while looking at firearms magazines. Alba remembered 2 to 4 occasions when someone from Riley Coffee came to the garage looking for Oswald. He recalled one time that someone said, quote, "If you keep this up, you're going to get canned." And Oswald would say, "I'm coming, I'm coming." Years later, Alba made additional statements to the House Select Committee on Assassinations that he did not make to the Warren Commission. Most notably, Alba said that he had a contract with the Secret Service to store 3 cars. One day, a man came to Alba and displayed FBI identification and also had a Secret Service pass that allowed him to check out one of the Secret Service vehicles. A day or two later, Alba saw Oswald approach this same vehicle at the curb outside of Riley Coffee. He was sure it was the same vehicle because the license plate was the same. Alba says that he, quote, "saw Oswald come out of the building, go over to the car, not hold a conversation of any duration, but take a legal-sized envelope, hold it to his stomach under his t-shirt, turn around in a crouch position, and go back into the building, straightening up as he went." Now, Alba did not mention this story about the FBI guy and the Secret Service car handing Oswald a mysterious envelope in front of Riley Coffee when he talked to the Warren Commission. He claims that he saw a TV commercial that jogged his memory after he testified to the commission. FBI agent Warren DeBries said the scenario that Alba described to the HSCA was very unlikely. DeBries said, quote, "I don't know if that's ever happened before where an FBI agent would be driving a Secret Service car. I'm not saying it couldn't happen, but the odds were 1,000,000 to 1 against those sort of facts existing." There's another potential anomaly with Riley Coffee. During the brief period when Oswald worked there, 4 of his co-workers were hired by NASA. Yes, that NASA. The National Aeronautics and Space Administration. Those 4 employees were Alfred Claude, who went to the Chrysler Aerospace Division of the Michaud NASA facility in New Orleans, Dante Maricini, who was hired on the same day as Oswald and also took a job at Chrysler Aerospace, Emmett Barbie, who was Oswald's immediate supervisor, also accepted a position at NASA in New Orleans, and John Brannion, another co-worker of Oswald's, went to NASA as well. Apparently, even Lee Harvey Oswald believed that he was going to get a job at NASA. Adrian Alba told the Warren Commission that about 3 weeks before Oswald left the job at Riley Coffee, he said that he had a new job at the NASA Michaud facility. Here's what Alba told the commission. Quote, "Oswald said, 'Well, I will be seeing you.' I said, 'Where are you headed?' He said, 'Out there where the gold is.' I said, 'Where's that?' He said, 'I told you I was going out to Michaud and that I had an application out there. Well, I have heard from them and I have just wound up things next door at the coffee company, and I am on my way out there now.'" The Warren Commission then followed up and confirmed with Alba that when Oswald said Michaud, what he meant was the NASA Michaud facility. After the assassination, NASA and its contractors looked for applications from Oswald, but they couldn't find any. So 4 people who were working at Riley Coffee get jobs at NASA in the brief two-month window of when Oswald worked there. Adrian Alba, a man Oswald spent a lot of time with, said under oath that Oswald told him the reason he was leaving Riley Coffee wasn't because he was fired, but was because he was taking a job at the NASA Michoud facility. To my knowledge, the coffee processing machines were not related to aerospace. So to see four people leave one company and all obtain new jobs at related companies in a two-month period is potentially notable, especially when that company is NASA. But on the other hand, it's also true that there were many aerospace manufacturing plants that were opening near New Orleans and doing a lot of hiring in 1963. So the mere fact that someone would go from Riley Coffee to a NASA contractor isn't impossible by any means. For me, whether or not this is suspicious depends on how many people worked at Riley Coffee at the time. I tried to find a document that said exactly how many employees were there in the summer of 1963, but I wasn't successful. If there were only 40 employees or so, then four people would be 10% of your workforce. And that would seem a little strange. But if there were more like 100 employees, then losing 4% of your people is a lot less material. As far as Oswald and the NASA Michoud facility, it's hard to pin down exactly what's going on here. Was Oswald fired for simply being at Alba's garage too much, as the official story says? Or did Oswald leave Riley Coffee to take a new job, which he thought was going to be working for NASA? The combined testimony of Adrian Alba seems to support both conclusions. In my view, there is enough evidence to show that there would be a reasonable basis to fire Oswald, since he would often skip out on work at Alba's garage. That could be enough right there. It's also possible that Oswald may have believed that he had the NASA job lined up, even if he didn't actually have it. If he did have the job, it doesn't look like he ever worked there due to the lack of records at Michoud. After Riley Coffee, Oswald didn't have any other jobs in New Orleans, at least not ones that generated W-2 statements. According to the Warren Report, Oswald and his family survived on very meager unemployment benefit checks for the rest of the summer of 1963 without receiving any additional income. Hey everybody, Matt Crumpton here. When I'm not researching, writing, or recording, one of my favorite ways to relax is with federally legal THC from Mood.com. This stuff doesn't come from a lab. It's pesticide-free and grown on American farms. You can get 20% off your first order using the code JFK. One of my go-tos is the functional gummies from Mood.com. These gummies only take 15 minutes to feel the effects, and you can choose all kinds of different moods, from creativity to pain relief to just plain old relaxation. Everything comes right to your door and is discreetly labeled. Best of all, not only is every Mood product backed by a 100-day satisfaction guarantee, you also get 20% off of your first order using code JFK. So head on over to Mood.com and find the functional gummy that matches exactly what you're looking for, and let Mood help you discover your perfect mood. Remember, use code JFK for a 20% discount. This episode of Solving JFK is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Fiscally responsible, financial geniuses, monetary magicians. These are things people say about drivers who switch their car insurance to Progressive and save hundreds. Progressive offers discounts for paying in full, owning a home, and more. Plus, you can count on their great customer service to help you when you need it, so your dollar goes a long way. Visit Progressive.com to see if you could save on car insurance. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states or situations. Judith Very Baker says that she also worked at Riley Coffee Company with Lee Harvey Oswald in the summer of 1963, and that she was his mistress. Baker's story was made famous in an episode of Nigel Turner's The Men Who Killed Kennedy. It is intensely disputed and has a lot of details, so let's start at the beginning. When she was a sophomore in high school, Baker won the science fair for creating a process to remove metal from seawater. She then was invited to a summer program for elite high school graduates to work in cancer research at Roswell Park Memorial Institute in Buffalo, New York. Everything I've said so far is documented with newspaper clippings, so Judith Very Baker was truly a legitimate science scholar coming out of high school. She said that while she was in Buffalo, her research caught the attention of Dr. Alton Ochsner, a renowned doctor from New Orleans whose Ochsner Clinic was the first ever to link smoking to cancer. Baker claims that she was invited by Dr. Ochsner to work on a top-secret cancer-related project with Dr. Mary Sherman, who was an orthopedic surgeon and professor at Tulane School of Medicine. Dr. Sherman worked for the Ochsner Clinic, so that part of Baker's story is supported by the record. But the part about Baker working with Dr. Sherman on a top-secret cancer project isn't supported by any documents that I could find. The story of how Judith Very Baker met Lee Harvey Oswald is that she was picking up her mail at the New Orleans post office. Here's how she describes it.
I dropped the newspaper, and this very clean-cut young gentleman standing behind me picked it up and handed it back. I looked at him, and he smiled, and he's young like I am, and he was so clean-cut and so polite that when he asked me if he could walk me home, I said yes. That was how I met Lee Harvey Oswald for the first time. I have to call it instant chemistry. I never felt such an attraction for anyone, either then or ever in my life since. It was love at first sight, and I know he felt the same way about me too.
In addition to claiming to be Oswald's mistress, Baker also says that Oswald introduced her to David Ferry, who Baker says was already friends with Dr. Mary Sherman and was working with her on a secret government project against Castro that was led by Dr. Ochsner. Oswald also took Baker to go visit Guy Bannister, who she says confirmed to her that Lee Oswald was working on a military project. She says that she and Oswald then went to go talk to Dr. Ochsner, who explained that the purpose of the project was to create a fast-developing cancer. Baker says that her time at Riley Coffee Company was strictly as a cover job that was given to her and Lee for their anti-Castro weaponized cancer research. She claims to have done lab work with mice at David Ferry's apartment and then brought the results of that research over to Dr. Mary Sherman's apartment. Baker also said that Jack Ruby once stopped by Ferry's apartment and claimed that he had known Oswald since he was a kid. And according to Baker, Clay Shaw felt bad for her and Oswald since the two lovebirds had nowhere to go. So Shaw paid for Baker and Oswald's hotel accommodations so that they could rendezvous during the afternoons. Baker says that all of her interactions with Lee were in the afternoons because Lee was always at home with Marina at night. Judith Very Baker's ultimate claim is that Oswald was a secret agent who found out about the plan to assassinate President Kennedy and tried to stop it. She says he was supposed to fire one of the shots, but he told her on the phone that he wasn't going to do it. Baker says that the last time she spoke to Oswald was on the Wednesday before the assassination. So Judith Very Baker claimed to have interacted with basically the main characters in the film JFK plus Dr. Mary Sherman and Dr. Alton Oxner. It's easy to immediately write off what she says as too fantastical, but it's the fact that she's fantastical in precisely the right ways that draws a lot of people in. For example, Dr. Mary Sherman, who Baker claimed to work with, was gruesomely stabbed to death and burned in 1964. Her murder remains unsolved to this day. So, if you're looking for a puzzle piece to support a conspiracy that fits a lot of the existing records and information that we know, it's tempting to believe Judith Vary Baker's very detailed story because it largely matches up with other famous subplots of the Kennedy assassination. But extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidentiary support. So, other than her own testimony, what evidence does Judith Vary Baker have? In the back of her book, Me and Lee, Baker provided W-2 statements for work at Riley Coffee Company from May 1963 through August of 1963, a period that overlaps with when Oswald worked there. And there's also Baker's friend, Anna Lewis, who said in a signed statement that's included in Baker's book that she and her husband went on a double date with Oswald and Baker in the summer of 1963. And as noted earlier, it's also true that Baker really was a standout science student who was chosen to work on cancer research at Roswell Park in Buffalo. Besides Judith Vary Baker's story being incredibly sensational, there's also the fact that she didn't come forward until 2001, when all of the information that overlaps with the evidentiary record was already known. Another challenge for Baker's story is that it seems to change over time. The more Baker's on the record, the more inconsistent statements she seems to make. Also, some of the most respected critics of the Warren Report, who have dedicated their lives to studying the JFK assassination, do not believe that Judith Vary Baker is telling the truth. For example, the late David Lifton, Bill Davey, James DiEugenio, Carol Hewitt, and John Armstrong are all on the record saying that they do not believe Judith Vary Baker. Here's John Armstrong on his interaction with Baker.
The only problem I ever had with Judith Baker is very simple. I talked to her a few times on the phone. I didn't know anything about her. And I simply mentioned to her how you looked a lot like Marina. And she said, yes, of course. Everybody mistook me for Marina. And so I asked her, I said, well, when's the last time you saw Lee Oswald? She said, September 63, before he left. And I said, okay. And at that time, people mistook you for Marina? And she said, of course. They were always calling me Marina. And I said, well, look, I'd like to ask you just one question. Marina was 8 months pregnant. Were you pregnant at that time? I gotta go. She hung up the phone.
Even though DiEugenio, Armstrong, Lifton, and company don't believe Judith Baker, there are still many people and studied researchers who do. The strongest evidence that she has is the W-2 and the pay stub for Riley Coffee Company. I haven't seen those documents discredited, but they also haven't been authenticated. Not a single person at Riley Coffee Company has come forward saying that they knew Judith Vary Baker or that she worked there. You would think that there would be at least one if she really did work at Riley Coffee. To me, Judith Vary Baker's story comes across as someone who became aware of all of the key players in the Kennedy assassination, especially the parts that pertain to New Orleans, and then inserted herself into history with all of these figures after the fact. I leave open the possibility that she did know Oswald and the W-2s may be real. I think it may even be possible that she was romantic with Oswald. Still, given the information that we just laid out, I don't think we can rely on any of Judith Vary Baker's claims as they relate to the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. Next time on Solving JFK, We continue analyzing Oswald's time in New Orleans, including his passport renewal and his alleged relationship with Guy Bannister. If you heard anything that you believe is out of context, or if you have additional information to offer, you can let us know at solvingjfkpodcast@gmail.com. Please provide citations to the record for any fact that you're relying on. For transcripts, sources, and official podcast merchandise, visit solvingjfkpodcast.com.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas.
The flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
Thanks for listening. Visit solvingjfkpodcast.com for more information.
Hey, I'm Dr. Z, and I'm a neurosurgeon. So that means long hours, early rounds, late nights, and everything in between. And through it all, I wear FIGS. Because they're built for what I do. Through the chaos, through the hours, and through whatever the day throws at me, they do their job so I can do mine. They're comfortable when it counts and functional when I need them the most. So where do you wear your FIGS? On shift, on call, on the couch in the break room listening to this podcast? Wherever it is, they fit right in. And now listeners of this podcast can get 15% off their first order. Just head to wearfigs.com and use code FIGSRX at checkout. That's wearfigs.com, code FIGSRX.